Amen. As I mentioned, my name is Father Archimandrite Sergius. I'm the abbot of St. Ticon's Monastery. St. Ticon's Monastery has five canonized saints who lived, walked, taught, were at St. Ticon's Monastery. That was St. Ticon of Moscow, who founded our monastery. He was came to America. I don't know if you know much about the American Orthodox Church situation, but the original mission came from Balam Monastery. There was eight monks. They were on a boat that came through St. Petersburg on its way to Alaska, and they came there in 1794. Very interestingly, like as they were on their way to Alaska, they stopped at St. Petersburg, and just so happened that Metropolitan Gabriel had just printed a newly minted, newly codified, newly edited, first time ever printing of the Philokalia. And we tend to take these books for granted as if they were like just, like everybody could go to the grocery store at that time and buy one, or go on Amazon, or even that they even had them. They didn't. There was no collection of these books, these very important texts that are in our patristic kind of dictionary or encyclopedia, or all of our the codification of these books didn't happen until relatively late. Just to back up for a second, it was St. Nicodemus, the Holy Mountain, and St. Macarius of Corinth, who in about 1720s, I think it was, they went around to all the monasteries on Mount Athos. St. Nicodemus was a very avid kind of collector and codifier of all these things, like canons and patristic sources and even Theotokian and all of these things, because these things weren't centralized at the time. Remember, the printing press just came out in about 1540 or something like that. So it's kind of a new thing to be able to have books, for people to have books. And in fact, the scriptures themselves, we take it for granted that there was no one Bible. There wasn't a book that was the Bible. That happened with the advent of the printing press. So the Protestant Reformation was concurrent with the advent of the printing press. And of course, there was, I think there was like the Gutenberg Bible or something a little bit before that. But as like an en masse being able to actually purchase a Bible, which was still very expensive, this is in mid-1500s. So in 1721, I think it was, they started to codify what we know as the Philokalia today. And they went and they searched all of the monasteries and all the places and all the these manuscripts for the most essential texts about Orthodox theology, spiritual life, and practice. And they put them into what we have in English. We have a five-volume set of these books. And they're kind of difficult. Patristic reading is not something that's just for everybody. And in fact, I would say if you really want to look at one of those books, a chapter in those books is just a couple lines. So it gives you an idea of just how deep and just how strong the medicine is. A chapter, that's what they call them. It's just a couple lines. It has usually a number, like let's say chapters on watchfulness by Hesychius the priest. Number one, it has two lines. Chapter 1. Chapter 2, 3 lines. Chapter 3, maybe 4 lines. And then chapter 4, back to 1 line. So this is a whole chapter in the what would be considered a chapter in the Philokalia, because really the information is so dense. And it's really oftentimes what we would consider a grace-filled or grace-bearing word. And so if you want to look at those books, by all means, it's fine, but just read a chapter at a time. Maybe one chapter a day, something like that. Like, that's all we need, and we need to do it with prayer as well. So those books came together, that compendium of the Philokalia. Philokalia means the lovers of beauty. So a lover, philo, and then kalia is beauty, so kalos. So those... And really, the lover of beauty is the one who practices the spiritual life. Because who is the most beautiful of all except God? So every beauty in this world has somehow a reflection of that ultimate, uncreated, and divine beauty which is in heaven. So that process of getting it into Russian, into Slavonic, or whatever it was first printed in, was tasked, and Metropolitan Gabriel eventually printed it. So in 1793, those eight monks they came to St. Petersburg and they received their copies of the Philokalia. And one of them was St. Herman of Alaska. St. Herman of Alaska's Philokalia is still at St. Herman Seminary this day. You can see it there. And it was really the foundation of the American Orthodox mission. This patristic, deep, spiritual perspective on how we pray, how we understand God, how we understand the virtues. All of these things are in the Philokalia, and I think it's his book is just one book. Yeah, it's all in there. But it literally is all in there. All of the Orthodox spiritual, it's a compendium of Orthodox thought and life and spirituality. So they were given that book. They came to America. It was 1794. That mission began, and that foundation of that mission, sure, they evangelized thousands of the Alaskan people, baptized many, many, many thousands of people. Sometimes in one sitting, you know, they would go to a village and or an area, and it would be tens of thousands of people in that time period. Eventually, St. Herman was the only one that was left. And St. Herman eventually settled on Spruce Island. I don't know if anybody's been up there. It was just his feast day the other day. And, you know, they have a pilgrimage every year there. I've been to Spruce Island. It's kind of interesting because, you know, it takes basically from my house to Spruce Island, it took 24 hours of continuous travel from door to door. And here I am. I've been in the, you know, a plane, a boat, a train, a this, a that, a bus. And we finally get to the dock on Kodiak because you have to fly in a little prop propellered plane over to Kodiak, which is this tiny little island. And you get out and you go to the dock. And my friend, Father Andrew, came on a little boat. And I was going to be there for about, I don't know, it was about 2 weeks or something like that, maybe 10 days or something. It was many years ago, so it wasn't like I was a really avid traveler at the time. You know, now I got it down because I go everywhere. But at that time, I had my luggage and this rather large suitcase and me and my backpack. We got into the boat, which was about the size of this carpet. And Father Andrew's in the back here with the motor, and I'm here with my big, large suitcase and my backpack. And we're in the middle of the ocean going towards Spruce Island. And it's literally like, you know, just water, like as far as the eye can see. You can see a little bit of land on each side. And I thought, oh my goodness, what have I done? I'm going to Spruce Island. So St. Herman's relics are on Kodiak, but his island is still there. And in fact, the interesting thing about St. Herman is that Bishop Benjamin, I remember he came, he was Bishop of Locum Tenens of Alaska for a number of years. And he said that when they were doing the canonization process, he wasn't the bishop at that time in the 70s, but he was still part of the committee and so forth, because the liturgical committee. And he said they would go around and they would ask the native peoples, they would say, what is your, you know, have you heard of any miracles of St. Herman, or do you know about you know, his life or any of these things? And they say, because he's up for canonization. And so they would, so many times the natives would say, he's dead. We didn't know that he had passed away. We see him so often. He seems to be interacting with us. He still seems to be active. When did he die? Well, it says in 1832. So it wasn't like, the saints oftentimes, this is a phenomenon in the Orthodox Church. I don't know if you know, but I mean, there are many saints that are still seen. And in fact, I know that the great martyrs, they seem to have a perpetual blessing to be able to appear to whoever they want, whenever they want, however they want. And there was even such a well-documented case of this in World War II, when I think it was a part of the Greek army was being hemmed in, and there was absolutely no hope. They were kind of almost going to be completely destroyed by the Nazis, and they began praying to St. Minas and St. George. And literally, like the newspaper account is, out of nowhere, there was these people on horses, and they came and they killed the Nazis and then they left. And it's literally in the historical books of this kind of strange, odd occurrence that happened in one of these battles in World War II, when the Greek soldiers were praying fervently to St. Minas and St. George that they would come to their aid. And, you know, eyewitnesses says there was a big flash of light, and out of the door of light came all these people on horses. They killed all the Nazis and they went back in through the door. So that is actually a documented like news kind of story that's actually in, if you look up in the papers, it's still there. It's in the Synaxarion as well as a footnote. But St. Spyridon is the same thing. You know, St. Spyridon, a lot of our saints are incorrupt. As you know, like St. John Maximovich, he's incorrupt. He's under glass. His hands, his beard, his hair, everything is still quite nice. That fact of incorruption is a sign of the grace of the resurrection and the life of the world to come that still so permeates that saint's not only soul but has gone into their body as well. So that staying power, that resurrection kind of grace and life which is present in the church, which has been transferred into their body and become so present, it's a tangible evidence to that reality. And they're literally just waiting for the second coming. But Saint Spyridon, who is in Corfu, I visited him, and they have to change, they say, his shoes every month because they wear out. He's also incorrupt. He's in kind of a big sarcophagus, but they literally, like, his shoes are dirty. So the fact that the saints are still with us and that they do help us in so many ways, it's evidenced in very unusual in different ways, but nonetheless, people see them, people experience them. See, Nicholas, our own experience of the saints at the monastery, St. Nicholas, I don't know, I told you this story probably, Josh, right? Josh is one of the workers at the monastery. He drove the car to bring me here. That's a miracle, right? Thank you, Josh. No boat needed. But St. Nicholas, we dedicated one of our houses to St. Nicholas. And so it's one of the new houses that we just built in 2020. And I love St. Nicholas. I went to see St. Nicholas in Bari. I've felt such a strong connection with him ever since I went to venerate his relics in Bari. They got moved from Myra to Bari in 1040-something or other. And he's there. He's underneath the altar. He's a myrrh gusher. So myrrh comes out of his relics every year. They collect it, and then they give it to the pilgrims as they come. But St. Nicholas, ever since then, has been just such a strong connection to myself and to the monastery, and really, indeed, such a powerful saint. The testimony that his memory is eternal. You know, it's quite a phenomenon to see that the saints just find a way to persist, even in the face of kind of like secularized culture. I think that Santa Claus is just the basic response of society to the fact that Saint Nicholas's memory is eternal. He might take a slightly different form, but he sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good, for goodness sake, right? So, but he also is one of those saints who is known to give gifts, right? You know, he would always be giving gifts, like remember the daughters that were going to be sold into some kind of situation, and he threw the gold into the window, and so St. Nicholas has always been this bearer of gifts. And of course, you know, what color typically do we wear during the Nativity fast when his feast is, if not red, right? And of course, he wore a funny hat because he was a bishop. So all that stuff has kind of morphed a little bit, but it's still kind of there. That's the persistent kind of presence of grace in this world and the society's response to our interpretation of that. And so there's Santa Claus. There he is. But it's St. Nicholas, Sinterklaas. Anyways, St. Nicholas, we prayed, the house was going up. I was the general contractor for the house because I built so many of them around the monastery that I just figured I would do it myself and save some time. But I had to get, when you're building a house, I don't know if you've ever built a house, but you have to get the power, you have to get everything wired inside first. And somehow you have to get the power company there at the same time as finishing all of the electrical to be able to hook everything up so that they can keep working inside. It was November, so I had to get this done. And it was during COVID, so they were not coming out. I'd been tapping everybody that I knew in the area to say, please come and help us because, you know, PPL, which is Pennsylvania Power and Light, they're very unresponsive. So I think it was just a little bit before the Feast of St. Nicholas or around that day. The power company said, once we come and put in the pole, if your power is not ready, we won't hook it up and we won't be back. We have a schedule that's like maybe a couple months out. So I was trying to push my electrician, who is very slow and methodical and very, you know, conscientious in a kind of annoying sort of way, to get this done. And we missed it. So they came and they put the pole down. The next day he was done with the power, and I was like, what are we going to do? Because it was already getting cold. There's nothing that they can do inside the house until they get the power on so they can keep working, because it's just, you can't have like paint dry and caulk dry and all these things that need to happen. So that night I said to everybody in the brotherhood, I said, let's pray fervently tonight to St. Nicholas that he would help us, because it literally is St. Nicholas' house. That's the house that's there. That's his name. It's dedicated to him. There's a mosaic of him out there. He's got his relics in there, his icon in there. Everything is, it's his house. So I said, everybody, please, let's pray to St. Nicholas that he would help us. And I heard something in the middle of the night. It was about 1:30 in the morning that night. It's like, what is going on outside? For about a half of an hour, there was all this ruckus and kind of chaos and strange noises and so forth. I woke up in the morning, and I went up, and the power was hooked up. The power company somehow came at 1:30 in the morning and hooked up the power to the house. Have you ever heard of that in your entire life? A service call in the middle of the night. I mean, if the power is out, it's one thing, right? They're out there working, but so that's the power of the saints, that they really do want to help us, that they are very powerful. I mean, most of the saints tell us about St. Nicholas. They say, if you really want some help, if you're in really big trouble, pray to St. Nicholas, because he's very, very quick to hear. I remember one lady, I was talking to some woman on the West Coast, and her father was one of the people that made it out of the Russian Revolution and was living in, I think, Europe at the time. Very pious man, though. And he stepped out into the street in front of a bus. And he just had enough time to turn around and see the bus coming right at him. And he said, St. Nicholas, help me. And literally, I think she said that she saw somebody there, and the bus just stopped, like literally, like it was an impossible situation that this bus would have had enough time to stop. But she says that she saw somebody, and he says that he saw St. Nicholas, and literally there was like, he should have just been, you know, completely pancaked. But that's the power of the saints, and you hear that a lot even in the lives of St. Silouan's father was like that, or St. Silouan himself went into the water, and as he was on a horse, the water, the pond broke, and the horse and him were going in. He said, St. Nicholas, help me, and all of a sudden the horse comes out, and he's back on the thing, and they're somehow continuing to move along. I mean, this is the power of the saints. They are a real phenomenon, a present phenomenon. We should call upon them as often as we can. You know, there's a really simple way to do spiritual life, and that's constantly asking God for what you need. You know, and to be thankful when you do get it. You know what I mean? And to be thankful even when we don't get what we want. Because you know how it is when we complain, it's awfully hard to give somebody who's complaining more. Have you ever noticed that? If you have a child, are you really inclined to give them more if they are not happy, complaining, tired, angry, ornery, etc.? It's the same thing with God and with us. It's the more thankful we are and the more well-disposed we are, that disposition is really everything, and it's one of the only things that we can actually control in our lives to some small degree. Everything outside of us, every person, everything, every phenomenon, every circumstance, we cannot control. But we can try, with God's help and prayer, to have a good disposition, to have a right orientation towards what's happening, because that negativity so often that we create only makes the situation worse, and actually like kind of creates kind of the phenomenon itself sometimes, because we have all these bad thoughts. We think, oh my gosh, here comes this person. I can't deal with them. I don't like them. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. It could be a spouse. It could be a neighbor. It could be a relative. It could be a child or a sibling. But so often we kind of create the situations that we are trying to avoid. And how do we do that? Because we think badly. Our own negativity kind of almost attracts it in a way that we become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I've seen it in my own life. Literally, you know, there's that book, it says our thoughts determine our lives. It's true. It's really true. And it's not just about positive thinking. It's more about prayerful thinking, I guess you would say. Because so often and not, you know, the fathers say that it's not in our power to not have bad thoughts. Bad thoughts will come. But it is in our power, they say, to either accept or reject them. So every thought's a little bit different, too. So certain thoughts you're going to have to treat certain ways. So let's say I'm having a judgmental thought about people, some group of people or somebody in particular. How do I deal with it? You know, because that judgmental thought definitely will come, right? But so often we lose grace because of our thoughts, our bad disposition, our judgmentalness, our lack of love, our lack of kindness, all of those things kind of proliferate in our thoughts. And then our heart, you know, St. Silouan says, by thinking evil, we become evil. So evil thoughts are not some kind of by-the-way phenomenon. So often the New Testament is so concerned, like you look at the Old Testament and you see the evolution of, like, here's Adam in the garden in communion with God. However we understand that, wherever we understand that, the fact was is that God made man and he made him in a way that was different than everything and everybody else. It's a fact. Even the fossil record bears that out. The missing link, right? There's something that happened long ago where there was this new thing. It's called man, woman. Here he is. Originally in communion with God, it was probably only for a short period of time because man in that state was like a baby. Didn't know what was going on. Didn't have a clue, you know, of how it actually, kind of the ramifications of his behavior. It's like giving a baby or a five-year-old or a 10-year-old $1 million and saying, you know, go invest wisely. It's like it's not possible to have a good investment profile for that 10-year-old unless someone helps him. So man is created in that place of communion. He falls away from communion. It was almost inevitable. God knew that that would be the case. It wasn't like someone's like, uh-oh, man has fallen away, what did we do? It was more just almost the inevitable outcome of being made in the image and having to mature and grow and learn wisdom and experience and how to attain and retain the grace of God. We all somehow mirror that in our own lives. From the time that we're a child up until about the time we're 12, we're kind of in the garden. Maybe 10, 12, 11, something like that. There's a certain innocence. There's a certain purity. There's a certain childlike simplicity and faith that is innate inside of us that attracts the grace of God. And we have our family. It's kind of like mom and dad are like, you know, it's this little Garden of Eden of sorts. And then somehow at between the age of 10 and 13, we kind of lose our minds. And so often we fall away from the church, from God, from our families, from sanity, because we enter into something called puberty, which is a very difficult time for most people. But there is this kind of falling away, and then we kind of have a return back to God. At some point, grace calls us back. It's replicated in our lives, that same phenomenon in the garden, and that happened with humanity as well. So man falls away from God, and then God has to take this whole process to be able to get humanity as a whole to be able to understand, okay, first, 2000 BC, Abraham says, listen, everybody, it's a huge statement, and everybody's going to, you know, really not like me, but there's only one God. They said, this guy's crazy. But that was something that was revolutionary at the time. Monotheism. It was different. Everybody thought there was a bunch of gods. Look at Hinduism, right? They say, oh, yeah, there's a bunch of gods. It's kind of like that. It's like that's a very primitive form of religion. Abraham said, there's only one. And then eventually Moses comes along 1,000 years later and he's got 10 commandments, 10 things that you have to do or can't do. So there's this process of kind of getting us back from the outer kind of like the outer form of life in God to the inner form, which is the New Testament. So you have the Old Testament, which is this outer kind of thing. Don't do this, do this. All these forms and concepts and precepts that are do's and don'ts and so forth. Outer stuff. Then the New Testament comes and it's incredibly essentially, concerned about your heart, the inner part, your thoughts. Concerned about your thoughts. One of the fathers said, if you keep all of the commandments in your thoughts, you already have kept them outside. If you can keep them in your thinking, then you've already done the harder part, and you'll by default be keeping them in your life and in your outward actions. So New Testament is quintessentially concerned with the heart. Most especially of not only about how to think, but even more specifically how to pray. And if there's one thing that monastics, Orthodox monastics do, and the Philokalic tradition do, is they talk about the deep prayer of the heart. There's three different kinds of prayer. We have prayer of the mouth, which is just verbal. We go to our icon corner, blah 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 blah. Amen. And we thought we did something. But the reality is we were just at the most basic level of prayer. We didn't even scratch the surface. You know, we might as well have been talking to the wall, because a lot of times if it's not connected to the heart, it's I would consider it has the potential to be, but not always, because we do need to start somewhere, but it could be vain repetition. You know, the kind of prayer that Christ says, don't do that. Because we think that we're doing something by doing that, but we haven't even started. That was just the door opening. Those three kinds of the verbal prayer, prayer of the mouth, prayer of the mind, and then prayer of the heart. And what happened at the fall was that the mind and the heart were separated. We are now fragmented. We're sometimes two people or several, lots of different parts and pieces kind of screaming and crying and yelling and saying no and yes and maybe, and I don't know, and we're confused. And the old man and the new man, they're fighting. And then there's these different parts of the passions which are trying to kind of torment us in different ways, because and just creates this kind of milieu of confusion inside of us. The only thing that brings that together is the grace of God through prayer. So what happens is that real Orthodox prayer is considered most specifically by somebody like St. Theophon as standing with the mind, this part of me, in the heart, which is this part of me, before the presence of God. Standing with the mind in the heart before the face of God. That's Orthodox prayer. It's pulling all of that together and then standing before God. And a lot of times it goes like this. A lot of our life of prayer is trying to kind of fit that seemingly square peg into the round hole, and it just keeps popping out because of the fall. It's for us now, it's counterintuitive to do that kind of movement, but the Neptic tradition of the church, the watchful Philokalic tradition, that prayer of the heart is the most essential core and key that Orthodox Christianity has for the world and for us. It really is the one thing needful. Martha, 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 thou art careful and troubled about many things. Martha's running around even saying, Holy God, Holy Mighty, Holy Mortal, right? But Mary has chosen that good part which shall not be taken from her, which is sitting at the feet of Christ, which means stillness. I'm sitting, I'm not doing anything. There's a certain amount of stillness, receptivity, openness. It's a different way of perceiving and approaching prayer, which becomes very deep and very transformative. The monasteries contain that kind of prayer. And in fact, they even considered that St. Anna's prayer and St. Joachim's prayer was of that same variety, because they couldn't have a child till very, very late in their lives. I think it was 50 or 60, which at that time was considered very old, because, you know, most people lived to be about 60 or so. I think, you know, the Mother of God passed away when she was 60. That prayer that they offered to God in their barrenness, they were rather wealthy, but they didn't have any children. And so basically in the Old Testament, you were anathema. If you didn't have children, you were barren. It was like, you were like persona non grata extraordinaire. You were not welcome. So the fact that it was so late and that it was so, in God's economy, timely, but it was through that deep anguish of prayer of heart that God came to them. and that Mary, the mother of God, was born through that prayer. Because you see, you read it in their life, the account of Joachim and Anna, about Joachim in the garden and Anna in the wilderness. They were both deeply kind of troubled to the point of it being inconsolable and pouring out their heart before God in such a tearful and profound way that God met them in that place. It's interesting that St. Sophroni says that oftentimes the most difficult times of our lives will be the most fruitful times of our lives. We don't like that. I don't like that. But that's what all of this is about. I'm sorry. But it's true, because the symbol and kind of the door to the mystery and the revelation of how God's life is and what God's life is for us and how we enter back into that life is the mystery of the cross. It's Christ's cross that reveals to us God's life, what that life is like for me, which is like, and then what my response to God has to be in order to go back through that. It's, if anything, the cross, it's the tree of life. This side of paradise, on the fall, it looks like this terrible thing. But on that side of paradise, it's the tree of eternal goodness, life, immortality, and blessedness. But for fallen man, it will always be a cross. And how to receive that in a gracious way? How to receive that in a way that's full of faith and hope and love? How to receive that in a prayerful way? This is the challenge for us. Because this happens to me all the time. The cross comes to me and I'm like, uh-oh. It's like, I don't want that. I can't do that anymore. But then somehow in the midst of my prayer, in the midst of patience, and in the midst of my divine massage that's happening to me and my soul, because, you know, God's working therapy in that moment, I say okay. And then God's strength comes in that moment. And fortifies me to be able to bear it. We have to have divine strength to do this. God has to strengthen us. He has to be the better part. I can't do it by myself. Gospel says without me you can do how much? How much is nothing? Zero. Zilch. Nada. Nothing. Without God we can do nothing, and that is a true statement. If we founded our life on that statement, we would do well. Because so often we take the reins and then things start to really go awry, right? Things start to fall apart. Why? Because it's so easy when you're made in the image of God and you're moving towards the likeness of God to not mistake yourself inadvertently and in some kind of functional way, but not in a theoretical way, for God. Easy to displace God in our lives. So easy. I find it myself, it's almost like if you were to put, you know, God in the center, and then you go off and you do something for a little bit, and you come back, and then it's, like, and then it's over here, and it's like, oh my gosh, I got to put it back in the center. And it's just this ongoing thing of trying to put God back in the center. Unless I'm constantly focused on it in the moment, I go off for a second, and then it's like, where did he go? And then I have to do this again, because the entropy factor of the fall is so high, and it's so real. It is so real. Entropy is the one thing, or we could say in Orthodox terminology, it's that the death that we all have been given. In the Old Testament, it says in the book of Sirach, God does not delight in the death of the living, because God did not make death. Very important. As an Orthodox thought of like how to think, because if anything, what, you know, my book that I wrote, Acquiring the Mind of Christ, that's an ongoing thing for all of us as we move from being in the image of God, which is a given, to the likeness of God, which is us choosing to follow Christ and be like Christ and to even learn how to think like Christ, and how the church thinks about the world and how the church looks at the world and looks at man and woman and God, how all of that thought process happens. I need to not only become like attuned to that, but I also need to start thinking like that too. So that we see each other as the image of God. That's what the church says. So we start to think like that. We know that Christ is God. We know that he is God incarnate, that he was the Word who was made flesh. So we start to think like that. We say, oh, that's who Christ is. We understand that God is three in one, three persons but one being, the Holy Trinity. So we start to understand, oh, that's who God is. And then at the epicenter of that phenomenon of God, we understand that God is person, which is this great revelation. You know, so often we take for granted the fact that we have such an inheritance, not only in the church, but even in the world, about how we understand the world. This concept of person, in about, I don't know, the third, the fourth century, it wasn't evolved like it is today. Our understanding of person, what it means to be a person, they didn't have it then. They didn't have it then. Of course, now we kind of tend to think, you know, individual, right? Individual is not person. Person denotes communion. Individual denotes separation or difference, how I'm different than you. An individual, it makes like I'm wearing this robe and you're wearing pink and you're wearing white and you're wearing gray, right? I'm thinking how I'm different than you. But as persons, person, as I think about person, it makes me think differently about people. So I say, oh, we're Orthodox Christians. Oh, we're all made in the image of God. I'm looking at how we're similar and how we're the same and how we're united and we take communion and we go to confession and we have similar problems and similar difficulties. This is how we kind of, again, functionally start to look at the world differently in the way that the church does, so that it actually helps us to be more healthy, more sane, and more together. Because if there's anything that we're fighting against, that enemy is death. There's only one enemy, St. Sophroni says, and even St. Paul says it too. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. And what is the epicenter of Orthodox Christianity if not the resurrection of Christ? Pascha. The whole liturgical year rotates around Pascha, right? So, right now we're so many Sundays away from Pentecost, which was so many Sundays away from Pascha. And then as we go back towards getting ready for Pascha, we start counting how many Sundays we are before we start preparing, before we start doing this. It's like you have this many preparatory Sundays, and then you have this many Sundays. How far are we away from Pascha? Everything is measured by this. Why? Because that is the victory over death. Christ says, I've come that they might have life, that they might have it more abundantly, to destroy him who had the power of death, which is the devil, and free those who were subject to bondage of fear all their lifetime. That's from Hebrews. Very important that we understand there's only one enemy, and it's not sin. Sin is bad, but it only comes from death. It's the daughter of death. It's the child of death. It's not innate in and of itself. Evil actually, from a theological standpoint, evil doesn't exist. Did you know that? Why? Because this world is created good. When God made the world, he looked at everything, he said, good. And then when he made us, he said what? Very good. So everything in this world is good. There's nothing wrong with matter. It's corruptible now because of the fall. So there was a change, but it didn't make it bad. There's nothing in our life that is innately bad or even evil. Evil comes when somebody wills it. That's how it comes into existence. St. Gregory of Nyssa says it doesn't have existence until somebody wills it. It comes about by the will. And so it's the same thing with, like, what is the struggle against? I mean, of course, you know, there are dark powers, evil spirits, rulers of wickedness in high places, St. Paul says. Our battle is not flesh against flesh and blood, but against rulers and powers and principalities in high places, he says. They will evil, and they try to subvert and cause evil in the world. In our thoughts, most often, that's the way that they try to work, because they also are. St. John Damascus says, angels, whether they're good or bad, are minds, M-I-N-D-S, in mental places. And when we fight with them, it's mind against mind. So St. Maximus says we need to remember that not all of our thoughts come from our own nature. He says they either come from, I don't know, it's like maybe like my guess is 20 to 30% comes from your actual physical nature. It's like, oh, I'm hungry. Oh, you know, this, that, the other. Maybe 20% come from, or 30% maybe from, 25 maybe, I don't know, a guardian angel or good angels. And then about 40%, 35 come from dark spirits. So any bad thoughts you have, oftentimes something's poking you, especially if it's like Lent, right? I can't, you know, I had this happen the other day. Excuse me. I had I got a water right here. Thanks, though. I had somebody call me on the phone. They said, me and my wife, it's over. And I said, well, I said, when did this start? Was it around August 1st when the Dormition fast started? I said, yeah. I said, just wait. Wait another few days and everything will be fine. And then a few days after the Dormition fast ended, he said, Father, everything's okay. But what is it that happens during the fasting period if not our thoughts go crazy? We just, you know, our cars explode, computers explode. I've seen things just, you know, large explosions at the monastery. Copy machines, the copy machine during the Dormition fast, it was like, you know, that thing that says waiting and the little wheel is spinning. The entire Dormition fast, that wheel was spinning. It's just, you know, you press the button on August 1st, it's uncanny, you know, the evidence of things not seen, right? But so often, and they don't only work with just our cars, but they work with our thoughts. Any bad thought needs to be rejected. Lustful, anger, judgmental, unkind. We need to think better. We need to think differently. And our thoughts are not just kind of by the way. They really do influence our surroundings in a way that is very profound. I noticed this at the monastery when I was, when I first took over as the abbot, which was about 15 years ago. I had one of the fathers who really didn't like me. Can you imagine that? Just kidding. You know, you don't have to spend all day with me, but anyways, it was difficult times, right? And I was very upset. I thought, well, you know, here I am. I'm working day and night to try to kind of, you know, everything was pretty much a mess there. They put everything back together. So I would get upset because, you know, here's this older monk who doesn't like me and thinking always bad about me and always saying bad things about me. And so I started thinking badly about him too because, you know, the Old Testament kind of tit for tat, right? You know, eye for an eye. And then I kind of, as I continued, you know, a lot of times the most important thing we could do is just start praying for people. You know, we don't have to, you know, don't have to fix people. I don't have to solve that problem. But I do have to love him and I do have to pray for him. That's the only thing that the gospel tells me to do. Bless, do good, and pray. It's a BDGP. It's in, you know, for our enemies and for our friends and for our neighbors, for everybody in the entire world. We bless them, we do good for them, and we pray for them. These are the three things that the gospel commands us to do. Doesn't ask. Doesn't say like your neighbor. It says love your neighbor. It's different. So I started to pray for him and I realized, hey, my thoughts about this person might be influencing this situation and making a bad situation worse. So I kind of did a little experiment. I thought, well, let's try this out. I said, every time I see him or think of him or I'm just going to make the sign of the cross and say, God bless, God bless, God bless, God bless. Because, you know, the bad thoughts were kind of proliferating in my head and it was difficult times and I was tired. I was working long hours. So I just would, every time I'd see him, I would, you know, I'd hear him coming down the hall and I would think, oh, God bless. My Lord have mercy, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy upon Father, so-and-so. You know, in my heart, in my mind, this is what I'm doing. God bless you, God bless you, God bless you. Lord, help him, Lord, bless him, Lord, save him. Lord, every good thing for this person, right? This was my thought process by choice. And slowly, things changed. Why? Because I changed. My own thought process was just feeding into his negativity and creating the situation that I was trying to avoid and didn't want. And it wasn't that he became the perfect person, but now we're fine. You know, it's a long time later, but after a few years, it kind of, you know, it worked itself out. But I wasn't party to it. I wasn't going to participate in it anymore. I was going to follow the gospel because that was the only thing I could do. And there was no credit to me. Why? Because God said, you got to do this. It wasn't like I figured it out, right? God tells us to do this, to bless, to do good, and to pray for all people, but especially our enemies. Why? Because in that moment that I pray for people that don't like me, people that are adamantly against me, people that are actively kind of working against me, in that moment I'm free. Free. I'm not tyrannized by their negativity anymore. I don't have to be subject to them. I'm not under their thumb because now I'm having a bad day because they're having a bad day. I can live a different life. Why? Because grace meets us when we live like that. Grace is part of us. It strengthens us to do it. And then somehow we can overcome anything. Greater is he that is in me than he who has overcome the he who is in the world. It's the scriptures. Grace has to strengthen us to do it. These are what the commandments are. It's the way that God actually lives. It's a revelation of God himself in kind of the physical, material world. His commandments are a light. His commandments are kind of the revelation of how God lives, and he wants us to live that way too. And it starts with our thoughts. If you don't know what to do, just start saying the Jesus prayer for the other person, your spouse, your neighbor, your friend, your child, whatever it is. You don't have to kind of figure out how to deal with every single bad thought. But we can start to pray for the other person. And in that moment, especially when I'm having altercations with other people, if I start praying for them, I can actually start seeing my part and work on that part alone. I leave the other part for them, and I work on my part. It gives me some space. And this movement of having more space and moving from reactivity to responsivity is a very deep spiritual principle, which is an absolute necessity. God's grace gives it to us. A life of consistent prayer gives it to us. But we have to kind of continue to move forward towards it, even when it seems impossible in certain situations, because God will meet us in those moments and enable us to do what he asks us to do. He can do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, St. Paul says. So, I didn't really finish about the American mission. But we do have five canonized saints at the monastery. That's how we started out. St. Tikhon of Moscow, who was a bishop in 1898, he was sent here as one of those bishops. The bishopric for Alaska was moved down to San Francisco. And then they moved it to New York City. And when they moved it to New York City in 1899, I think, 1901 maybe, that was when they said, we need to have a monastery for the church in America. And the entire church in America was kind of under the Russian mission. So St. Raphael was the first consecrated bishop on American soil. And he was consecrated by St. Tikhon of Moscow. St. Raphael was the one who consecrated our altar at St. Tikhon's monastery. He was there. He was there for the first pilgrimage, 1905. St. Alexis of Wilkes-Barre, who through his work, he brought in about 13,000 to 20,000 people, something like that, into the Orthodox Church. And then their descendants, it was 400,000 people into the Orthodox Church. St. Nikolai Zica was our rector in the 50s, a great Serbian poet, statesman, saint, academic. He was just an extraordinary individual. St. Alexander Hodovitsky, who was martyred under the Bolshevik communist government in, I think, rather late. It was like the 30s. He went back to Russia and then was martyred. But those are our saints that are known, but we have many unknown saints as well. And that place is such a place of blessing and power. We invite you always. You're always welcome to come visit there, to go visit our website and have prayers offered there. We do liturgy, as I mentioned, every day. But just knowing that those places, not only in America, but all over the world, that those places, that prayer, that real prayer, both, you know, there's liturgical prayer and then there's personal prayer. And the point of liturgical prayer, you know, St. Dionysius says there's three liturgies that are going on or need to be going on. One is in heaven. It's always going on. It's the worship of God. There's one on earth, which is in the church. It happens some places every day, sometimes on the feast days, some days mostly on Sunday. And then there's one that actually needs to happen in our hearts. And St. Dionysius says the purpose of the heavenly liturgy the purpose of the liturgy on earth that takes place in the church is to be able to unite the heart to the liturgy that's happening in heaven, so that the liturgy is actually served at the altar of the heart. This is what eternal life is. It's about how the grace of God and the presence of God comes to like really actually concretely abide in my heart in such a way that, just like those saints that we talked about, it is so suffused with that life-creating and eternal grace that even we could become incorrupt. Like, it has, our salvation is a real thing. We have to experience God. We have to know God. This is what we talk about every second Sunday of Great Lent when we talk about St. Gregory Palamas. We constantly are coming back to that. Why do we keep commemorating St. Gregory Palamas? Because he said, so importantly, just a couple things that are just essential. One, you can know God. As an Orthodox Christian, you must know God. You can know him and you need to know him, and that knowledge is salvation. That they may know thee, Christ says, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom thou hast sent, in the 17th chapter of Matthew. That knowledge is biblical, which means communion. So that knowledge of God is the most precious thing that the Orthodox Church has. We can know God, we must know God, and this is our salvation. So prayer of the heart is really that door or that beginning of the knowledge of God. Be still and what? That is how we enter into the mystery. We don't, academic work is great. Reading is wonderful. But it has to be concurrent with a life of prayer, which needs to be consistent. And we'll talk about more kind of thoughts about prayer, how to pray consistently, and what that kind of means. It's a great mystery that we enter into again and again and again each day as we go to do it. So we can talk about it and try to go deeper into that mystery, because it really is the one thing needful, to learn how to pray from the heart in an Orthodox way and know God. This is why we're here. This is what we're doing here tonight. This is what is that one thing needful that brings a true fulfillment to the soul. We don't wonder why we're here anymore. We don't wonder what we're doing. We know why we were made. We were made to know God. And that knowledge makes us eternal as well. So, glad to be with you. I'm in an Airbnb. Very nice. I always wonder, it's like, whose house is this? Is this someone's house? Did they live here? Are they gone? Are they coming back? Is that their food in the fridge? They left some cookies. That was nice. Was that you?
No.
Oh, okay. It's quite a phenomenon. I'm sorry. But it's nice to be with you. Does anybody have any questions or thoughts? There's a few minutes here. And you can even save them for tomorrow, too. But don't be afraid to ask questions, because there's no dumb questions. And a lot of times the questions that you have are the ones that other people have as well, and are kind of like essential to be spoken about, talked about. It helps us kind of facilitate a discussion. I teach at a seminary, so I'm used to this kind of thing, and I feel that interactive part is the better part. Yes. Saying something about the second coming, yes. Yeah, well, that concept about, it's called inaugurated eschatology. That's what the church is. All the stuff in the church, there's a certain foreshadowing or it's like a beginning of the world to come. That's what the church is. It's this thing called inaugurated eschatology, which means that the kingdom is here, but it's yet to be consummated or fulfilled at the second coming. So Christ comes, he inaugurates the kingdom in his own person. It's the person of Christ, it is the kingdom. He says to the disciples, he says, "Verily I say to you, there are some who will not taste of death until they see the kingdom of God come in power." And then they went up on the Mount of Transfiguration, and Christ reveals to them his divinity, which is that light of the kingdom, which is his person. It's the light of God. It's the person of God. And they saw it come with power. So that kingdom has come. It's been inaugurated in the person of Christ through the incarnation, through the theophany in the Jordan, through the death and the resurrection, through the ascension to heaven, through the giving of the tongues on Pentecost. All that great mystery of kind of the kingdom has been fulfilled and culminated. And it's wonderful, those prayers that we read on Pentecost about how this great and last saving day, about how that fulfillment comes about through the giving of the Holy Spirit, that everything is kind of done at that point. All things have been made ready. So in the church, everything that's in the church, like let's say this icon, some icons that are miracle-working icons, they are more or less indestructible sometimes. I've seen icons that, let's say like in Chicago, in Cicero, they had their entire church burned down. They had a miracle-working icon that was on the iconostasis, an icon of the Mother of God that was weeping for about maybe 3 months. It made it on the news. It was like in the mid-90s. It was like 93 or 94. About a few years later, the entire church burned down. Completely razed. Five-alarm fire. It was terrible. They came in the morning. There's all these smoldering ashes. And everything was gone except that icon of the Mother of God. And the only thing was just like a little bit of smoke damage, just a tiny bit. And it's still in the church today in Cicero, Chicago. That area. Same thing has happened like with the Kirschgruet icon, the Tikvin icon. I mean, Father Hilary is telling me that Father Sergei Garklavs and Archbishop John of Chicago, they were literally in the boat. They had the Tikvin icon of the Mother of God, which is this very, very old icon that they took from Russia during the Russian Revolution. It's known to be at least from the 5th or the 4th century. They think that St. Luke painted it. But this icon, literally they're leaving the harbor. They're on one of those boats. It's World War II. The Nazis come. All these bombs start bombing everything, and they're right above the boat. And Archbishop John and his son, Father Alexander Garklavs, they say the bombs go like this. And like this, the boat is going away, and like these bombs are like literally like going like this, like, and the boat is not harmed. It leaves, and they come to America with this icon, the Tikvin icon, the Mother of God, which was here for like 50 years. It was just returned like in 2004 back to Russia. It was a really big deal. But that kind of incorruptibility of the kingdom, which is the grace of God, which is in the church, which is present in us and in this place. It's evidence of the kingdom to come. There's a certain kind of foreshadowing in the matter of this world today of that kingdom which is to come. And it's evidenced by the incorruption of the saints and the incorruptibility of some of these icons. Even like, let's say, like the gospel, you know, they have a gospel. It should definitely have been disintegrated a long time ago. But there's a gospel of St. John, St. John's gospel from 130 AD, you know. There's just those kinds of things. It just, they shouldn't still exist, you know. They shouldn't really be around. It's almost impossible for them. But there is a certain amount where these things persist. The relics of the saints that are myrrh streaming, that are myrrh gushing. There's so many instances in which this takes place. But the kingdom is now. The grace of God, which is the kingdom, is in the church. We partake of it as Christ, members of his body, and we become eternal ourselves to some extent. We become eternal even in our bodies, because this body will rise at the last day. If death isn't natural, if God didn't create death, if death is something that kind of happened as kind of an accident, as it were, or by the will of man, his choice to go away from God, which God foreknew but he didn't will, then that means that that grace of life, which is kind of evident or in within the world, that renewal of the creation comes about in the incarnation, and it makes this world like that we're in, our bodies, this is what's going to rise on that day. This body will rise again. I look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come in this body. Christ went up into heaven, sat at the right hand of God the Father in this body. He had tortillas and hummus and mandarin oranges and some olives and stuff like that, and that on, you know, at the Last Supper, and then up he went, you know, in that body. With this world, with all this, you know, we tend to kind of divorce ourselves in this world. It's just like, we're not this world. Oh, no, that's, you know, that's out there, and that's not good. It's bad. It's, you know, the world. But we eat the world all the time. We're constantly kind of communing with the world and partaking of the world. Air, elements, minerals, you name it. It's going into us, and it's coming out of us where there's this interchange. We are the world. It's St. Silouan says, what is the world if not the body? So that world is what's saved by Christ. God so loved the world, all of the world, which is the matter of the world and your body, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That world is what is saved in God. That world is what went up and sat at the right hand of the Father. That world is what will somehow be renewed, reconstituted, and regenerated on that last day. And St. Nikolai says that the force of the second coming itself will be so powerful it will raise the dead. Like, it'll be that serious of an event. So it's a concept that's kind of difficult, but it is called inaugurated eschatology. It means the kingdom is already here, it's in the church, and it's in the matter of this world. The Eucharist conveys to us the life of God himself. It's the matter of this world that conveys to us God's own life in the bread and the wine of the Eucharist. The church operates on that same principle on so many levels. The matter of this world conveys to us the grace and the life of God. That's what sacraments are. That's what sacramental living is. It's a way of looking at the world so that we can always see God. Blessed are the pure in heart, for why? They're going to what? Where? Everywhere. In all things. In everybody. And in everything. Why? Because it's this incarnational vision of how we look at the world as a sacrament of God's love, of his presence, and of his life. And it only comes about through living that ascetical kind of mystical, prayerful life of the church, the sacramental life of the church, where that kind of stuff starts to open and the opaqueness of the world is dissipated and the clarity begins to be more real and more true and more abiding. So it's a good question, kind of complicated, especially at 8:30 after I've been in the car for 20 years. It's a far ways away from South Canaan. So one more question maybe? Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, it's heavy. It's heavy stuff. But most of the stuff, like, let's say, you know, patristic theology, just in general, right? It's kind of like meat and potatoes, right? And maybe we're not quite experienced enough, or maybe we're a little bit more young, and maybe we can't eat as much, or maybe it's too much for our stomach, or whatever. But the basic distillation of, like, whatever I offer you is from those books and from the patristic kind of witness. So it's a matter of, like, a lot of times the, like, let's say St. Silouan, right? St. Silouan, St. Sophroni, Father Zacharias. This is our lineage at St. Tikhon's Monastery. St. Sophroni, St. Silouan are those God-bearing fathers whom God inspired who saw God. Just like St. Paul, just like the prophet Isaiah, just like the prophet Moses, just like all the prophets in the Old Testament and all the saints in the New Testament, they all saw the light of God. You know, evidenced in their writings, evidenced in their life, but especially St. Sophroni and St. Silouan, just like St. Paul. They saw that light of the kingdom which is to come, and it so transfigured and altered their being and their state that they were literally released from the fall in their own person. Like, they overcame the death that was in them through that light. And it was only after a tremendous amount of struggle that they were granted that. But because they have that authentic witness of that kingdom, which is incorruptible and which is true and which is in the church, the Orthodox faith, they are able to kind of digest and redact and kind of put it into component parts what's most essential and what even their writings are still a little bit difficult. But like, let's say St. Silouan, it's if you read the second part of the book St. Silouan by Father Sofroni, St. Sofroni, that second part is just his writings and anybody can understand them. It's all the same kind of spirit. It's all that same line of thought. So we just have to find living witnesses, contemporary witnesses that have kind of redacted and digested some of these things and can offer it to us in a very kind of bioavailable form. St. Silouan is one of those people. If you read the book St. Silouan the Athenite, that second part of his writings, it's like gold. It's so perfect. It's so simple. Anybody can understand it. And that's the mystery of kind of like gospel, like the level of what the gospel is at. It's universal. It's for all people. I remember being in church as like a five-year-old kid, and I heard that parable about the widow and the two mites, right? And I'd just gotten my allowance. And I said, well, look what I can do. I put the whole dollar into the basket. And I was so excited that I could participate in the gospel, but I understood it. That was the point. I was 5 years old, but I got it. That's the universality of the gospel. It's like whoever you are, wherever you are, you can understand it. It makes sense to all people everywhere. Patristic writings can be, they're written for a specific time, a specific place, and a specific person. Always so important to understand the context of those writings. And again, that's why I say, like, if you really want to read the Philokalia, this is, you read, you do, we'll talk about this tomorrow, but you do, like, kind of a consistent prayer rule of some sort where you have a bit of, like, preparatory time, and then you just read a tiny, 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 tiny bit. So, you know, like St. Hezekiah the priest, his texts on watchfulness are fabulous, but I would only read maybe a sentence at a time each day. That's it. It's enough because it's such strong medicine. And not all of it's going to be applicable, you know, and that's so important to have that discernment to be able to like, oh, this is not for me. I'm not a hermit in the fourth century, or I'm not, you know, on a mountaintop living by myself. I, you know, it's so important to understand context because we can take things out of context and try to run with them and we get discouraged or we start beating other people up with it or whatever. You know, we get kind of crazy with this stuff, but always having a context is really important to understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-oh. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a certain kind of order that actually is better. So it's not set up like it's supposed to be. It's like reading the dictionary. Apples. Apolopolops. Apocatheri. You know, like you're reading it in this encyclopedic kind of like context where there are like, if you look at Father Maximus Constas, he has like how to read the Philokalia, which is like you start with this person in the third volume and then you go to this person and say, and you don't read everything, you know what I mean? So I definitely wouldn't, you know, if you're going to take the time to read something, read somebody like St. Silouan. Read somebody like Father Zacharias. I brought Father Zacharias. Father Zacharias is my spiritual father. He's St. Sophroni's disciple. St. Sophroni is St. Silouan's disciple. St. Sophroni was ordained by St. Nikolai of Zicha, who was our rector. We've had a long-standing relationship with them, and their spirit and their witness, their understanding of spiritual life is the most attuned and appropriate for our time and for our Western context. St. Sophroni was a great saint, but he lived in England. He knows what it's like to be like with people like us, you know? It was that experience that helped Father Zacharias to take his writings and kind of redact them and reoffer them to us because his writings are also sometimes a little difficult. I only read a little bit at a time when I read St. Sophroni, but I can read quite a bit of Father Zacharias. But Father Zacharias has a new book on hesychasm. And again, it might not all be applicable to everybody, even to me, but you just take what you can, you know? It's like, oh, that's not for me, or I can't use that right now, or it's a little bit above where I'm at. It's like, fine. You know, it can humble us. It can help us to just, you know, be inspired and let it be for someone else. So. Yes, sir.
Actually, I have two questions. One, do you guys still have
first answer, St. Nikolai, we do have a small portion of his relics. He actually did want to be buried at St. Tikhon's, but they came in the, he died on a Saturday morning. They came on a Saturday afternoon. They took him away to the cathedral in New York. He was buried at Libertyville, and then he was transferred back to Lalich, which was his home village, but he did want to be buried at St. Tikhon's, and he wasn't. About the person who is, no longer in the church, it's a difficult question. It's painful. Depends on how close they are. If it's a family member, it's one thing. If it's somebody more distant, it's another thing. But good question. There's a certain aspect to the church's life where we just kind of leave it to God, and we don't judge. But we don't necessarily engage or try to fix or kind of, justify or condemn. There's a saying in St. John Climacus says, by condemning the defiled, we become defiled. So I would say, God bless them, no comment. Hope they come back, we leave it in God's hands. Because to condemn somebody like that, it's like sometimes people are on a journey and you don't know exactly where they are and where they're coming, and we might be on the outside and they might make it back in, or we don't know. The St. John Climacus again said, wondrous it was in one moment. Judas was in the company of the Lord, and the thief was in the company of murderers, and wondrous how it was in one moment they changed places. So we just don't know. That's why we just kind of leave it to God, and we just don't have much comment on it, except that's not a good idea. But really it's only by grace that we can say that Jesus Christ is Lord. It's only by the Holy Spirit. So if we lose grace, if we lose the Holy Spirit to a great degree in our lives, these things will become kind of inaccessible to us. And it's, it's a sad thing. It's a sad thing. So, Father, thank you so much for having us tonight. St. Anne will be back in the morning. And like I mentioned, it's kind of rare, but we do have a lot of different relics at the monastery, and I brought St. Matthew, so that's very exciting. It's not a normal relic to have. A lot of these relics that we have are not your usual ones, but we're glad to be able to share them with you, and we'll look forward to talking with you some more tomorrow.